Talk given Saturday, 1st March 1975. In recent meetings, we have been considering the somewhat unique meditation known as the Brahma Vihara, unique insofar as its development in Buddhist practice is unique. It's an ancient teaching. It's definitely a pre-Buddhistic teaching. You will also find it, for instance, in Patanjali's yoga aphorisms. You will find it in several of the Upanishads too. But there you just get a statement in the form of a list of the different states of the Brahma Vihara, the divine abidings. As we saw last time and time before, this teaching was given out by the Buddha, usually in two situations, one or other situation. If somebody came along and asked, "Show me the way to union with Brahma," then this teaching of the divine abidings was given out. And as it was also given out to the Buddha's own bhikkhus, as part of their general discipline, their daily discipline. It is the teaching about love, starting at our human level and outgrowing that human level, emerging into the transcendent itself, the transcendental level. And we know that there are difficulties attached to it. We touched upon them last time. I will not repeat that. So that's one of our problems in connection with the practice of the Brahma Vihara. There is also another very difficult problem which faces us in the modern world, particularly more than it troubled people in past centuries, when world conditions were slightly easier, more conducive to the religious life than they are now. Our great problem is, how do we live religiously in the modern world? In the world of business, of politics, economics, and all the turmoil and upheaval which goes on. We can't relate the two. How can we live the moralities, the simple moralities, for instance, absolutely? We can live them relatively. In our speech, is it possible to be absolutely truthful at all times and in all places? Or have we got to be a little bit tactful, a little bit diplomatic? Or have we got to try and persuade the other person round to another viewpoint and so forth? All of which belongs to the worldly level, and it belongs to the plane of conflict and of that state of awareness of existence, which is not the religious state, to put it in other terms, which is not the truly human state. It is the subhuman state. These are very serious, very difficult problems. They seem trite on the surface, but actually they go very, very deep. Now, let us look at this matter afresh. That is, let us look at it now and try and pay full attention, putting aside our preconceptions and our past knowledge. Follow it very carefully. The discipline of the religious life affects the transformation of the whole person. It changes him from being a worldling into being a true human being, a fully realized being. This transformation of the whole person is essentially distinguished by the transformation of his mode of awareness of existence. This is a point of the greatest importance. This transformation of the mode of awareness. The worldling is aware of existence in terms of himself and a not-self. His awareness of himself is a distorted, confused, inaccurate, hopelessly mistaken awareness of himself. He has an image of himself which is not true to the reality. Similarly, he has an image of the not-self, the world around him, that is, which is not true to the reality. But the fundamental source of conflict lies in his being aware of himself as separate from the not-self, his fundamental illusion. That is his mode of awareness. Now that mode of awareness undergoes a total transformation. And it is this, the nature of this transformation and the means by which it comes into being, which is the golden key to the living of the religious life. This is the real secret in actual practice. Now, you have heard it said over and over again, 10 times, 100, 1,000 times, that attentiveness is the key to it. Now we might say, yes, I have practiced being attentive and watchful and mindful. All these words mean the same sort of thing. I have practiced mindfulness for the last 30, 50 years, and I don't find myself any foreigner. Consider the nature of this attentiveness. What is it that vitiates the attentiveness at the source? It is the fact that I am attentive in terms of a self and a not self. In other words, there is perpetually an I, there is a me, extracted out of the one total reality, who is being attentive or trying to be attentive to this total reality, which I say gratuitously is part and parcel of that totality. But although I may sincerely believe that I am part and parcel of the totality, equally sincerely without my being conscious of my sincerity, I hold on to the I as a separate thing out of that totality. This is the trouble. This is the problem. I cannot be aware of myself, as I commonly say, and of the world, only as one total reality. There are always two. It is I who am being conscious of that totality. Therefore, how does my mindfulness actually function all the time? It functions in this way. I pay attention to all the stimuli that can enter me through the sense organs, or that rise up from within through memory or some sort of stimulus, whatever it may be. I attend to them as something related to me. Now, if they are, this attention makes me aware of everything in the world as being related to me, I am trying to draw the world unto me. I have preconceptions about myself. All my desires, my feelings, my instinctive search for comfort, pleasure, happiness, security, success, love, all these things operate all the time for me. I cannot get rid of that fundamental selfness. If the intellect wakes up and says, "Ah, I am being selfish," I again am being selfish, and I ought not to be. And therefore that is the state of conflict, and the state of mindfulness is really out of the situation. It has been replaced by a state of conflict. This relating of our whole life to the me is the trouble. As long as there is, even deep down in the innermost depths of the subconscious or unconscious, so long as there is this me operating, attentiveness is vitiated. You cannot really attend. The total attention, therefore, really is one in which self-consciousness, isolative self-consciousness, is completely out. Now, what is the first question that will arise in the mind of the person who sincerely wants to live the holy life? You say, "Well, how do I get rid of this?" It's the wrong question. Who is getting rid of it? I. But the I is in the forefront still. You see, the naturalness and the spontaneity, the non-separatively conscious state, is not present. This separative state is there both with the conscious mind as well as in the deeps of the unconscious. If I say I want to conquer this or get over it or something, well, the I is paramount. That is all. Therefore, as long as our mindfulness, our attentiveness, is related to oneself, which means that one is conscious of oneself going through a discipline in order to obtain a result, the attentiveness is not pure attentiveness. And the transformation of your mode of awareness of existence cannot take place. We may have our sublime and exalted moments, moments of wonderful beauty and charm, moments where we feel we are completely at one with the universe and all the rest of it. But if you look carefully at all those wonderful experiences, wonderful in the sense that they are very pleasant and exalting, what is it that gets exalted? The self again. In the experience. And we treasure the experience in our memory, and we are constantly wanting it repeated. And we say, oh, why can't I be in that wonderfully happy, blissful state I was in that day in the woodlands when the sun shone and some miracle took place and I was at one with all nature. I was at one with all nature. You see, it's a lifelong task to wake up to the obtrusiveness of the I consciousness upon our whole life process. This is the thing, this obtrusiveness of the I consciousness. There also come those wonderful moments, the truly wonderful moments, when one is unself-conscious. What I am saying is, not un-self-conscious, but unself-conscious. You get it? The perfect attentiveness, the attentiveness which characterizes the religious state, is this unself-consciousness. You are quite awake. You are in the truly enlightened state, fully awake. That means you are conscious. Consciousness, awareness is present. But it's not a self-awareness, a self-consciousness. It is an unself-consciousness manifesting through you, the particular organism. When it happens, say it happens to you or it happens to me, I don't know it at the moment. There is no calculation whatsoever. Now, look at another aspect of this. In the state of the worldling, when I am practicing, deliberately practicing mindfulness, observing everything that comes through the senses, I interpret all that in a certain way. Have you ever looked into the nature of that interpretation? It is always an interpretation which keeps one bound to the subhuman state. It will always be an interpretation which is spoilt by one's own pleasure drive, one's desire for security, for achievement, for attainment, by one's own fears and anxieties. Am I getting on? Am I making progress? Or am I going off my head? And so on and so on. You see, one can't avoid this. We may feel that, but surely I'm not like that. I'm looking at the thing quite dispassionately. The conscious mind says that to me, but the conscious mind is deceiving me there, trying to deceive me, because it is terrified of losing its anchors, that which it already knows, in the light of which it interprets. But you see, every interpretation in the twilight, the dark light, I should say, of my own desires and my mental processes, every such interpretation is bound to be a misinterpretation. The transcendent is the unknown. It is the totality. It is the non-finite. It is the unbound. It knows no fear. Yajnavalkya tells his disciples, like King Janaka and his own wife Gargi, Maitreya rather, tells them the Atma is not this, not that. It does not tremble, is one of the things he says. There is no fear in that situation. Transcendence is like that. It is non-finite. But I am finite. I am in a state of fear because I cling unconsciously to the continuation of my own existence. Do we find it easy not to oppose death or to stave it off? Do we ever greet death in any form? Leave alone the death of one's own body. Put that aside for the moment. But death in the sense of a loss of some possession or a friendship or an opportunity, etc., 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 or a change of ideas, having to give up old ideas because truth in a form less inaccurate than before has come up before you? Don't we cling to the old? If that is the case, where is the infinite? Where is the totally new? The totally new is always emerging out of transcendence, because transcendence is creative power in action. The action which is action in eternity, in which there is no repetition. That is the pulse of life. Action in the supreme sense, that's the supreme meaning of the word karma. Creative action, which is without cause, which has no problem of cause and effect and all the rest of it. You see? So I, the finite being, am ignorant enough, confused enough, foolish enough to want both worlds. It cannot be done. And the not so very perceptive say, you can only have the one world or the other. I do not at all subscribe to that either. It is not a case of discarding one world for the other, because that again is a state of separation. There is only the transformation process going on all the time. This has to be borne in mind. The state of consciousness, the awareness of existence in terms of the worldling, has to become completely changed into the awareness of existence in terms of the true human, the one in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out, is expunged, where the mind is transparent, empty, free, free of everything. So these are the difficulties that face us in the practice of mindfulness. We don't even know the nature of mindfulness properly. We don't know it. We think we do. But look into it carefully and see how we fall down every time. Oh, no, I made a mistake. 10 years later, someday I say, oh, I've got it at last. And I go pelting along quite gaily. 10 years pass by and I say, no, I made a frightful error 10 years ago. And I know the humiliation of defeat. And I know it again 20 years later. And 30 years later, and I have known it personally 40 years later. So I'm speaking out of actual experience. But you see, you must let the hound of heaven hold you in his jaws. And that hound will lay you down finally on the altar of transcendence itself. Once you really care and you let yourself go, give yourself to this hand of heaven who is inside you, he will take you there. He'll take you to the state. He'll take you there because you have ceased to resist. You are in his mouth. It's no longer I going there. But there's something which you cannot see, hear, touch, taste, picture, imagine. This transcend, this power of transcendence itself takes you in. And then your attentiveness is totally different. And everything that comes to you through the senses will not be interpreted by one's own confused, distorted, pleasure-driven, desire-imprisoned mind. When all that interpretation has ceased, the fact becomes perfectly clear. The fact of the situation itself. Then you really see. Now, when you really see what is the nature of that seeing, consider again my ordinary seeing. I, a person, am seeing that a piano, that a human being, that a book. I am seeing that which is other than me. You get it? I am the seeing subject, always separated from the seen object. But when there is real seeing in the religious sense, the seeing by the emptied mind, the purified mind, the unresisting person, the utterly resilient person, then there is no I seeing an other. But this which is called I is that which it sees. It is seeing by being. Now you will understand then that this kind of seeing is not an analytical seeing. When you see that way, when you are looking at a cloud, or hearing the song of a bird, or whatever is happening, there is no analysis of it at all. There is no finite, limited, and limiting recognition process at work. When you see a blade of grass or a star twinkling in the heavens, a grain of sand or a huge elephant or a mighty mountain range or the whole sky, when you see any one of those things, you will be seeing the totality simultaneously. Because you won't be seeing with your eyes. Your eyes will still be the physical instrument, the physical tool by means of which impressions will be reaching the brain, true enough. But you, in your inner awareness, your completely awakened awareness, will see totality in it. In other words, the seeing is in terms of unself consciousness. And this is, I would say, the normal, whole, human state. This person is the Son of Man. The Manasa Putra, the son of mind. The son of man, take it from its original roots, its Sanskrit root of man, creative thinker. How do I ordinarily think? I think about this and about the other. I am an image maker. If I was capable of real thought, the moment I think, that particular something has come into manifestation, into being. And God thought light, and there was light. That is the way to look at it. Quite a different thing. Then you see, the living person is completely in tune, in line with this creative pulse of life. What an extraordinary destiny is man's destiny. Someday he'll be like that. By and large, mankind will be like that. The great teachers whom we have had in our own history are the first fruits of humanity. They realized this state. But they found it, quite naturally, found it very difficult to put it in words. Not for a moment do I suggest I have put it in words, not a bit of it. I have used words to suggest, to spark off, trigger off, a mode of awareness in him who can listen. And if you do listen and can listen in the right way, you will be hearing my words, but you will be listening to the eternity of the silence and the stillness within your own being. that silence and stillness is the truth itself. It is not separate from sound. That silence contains all sound. And when the word of truth gets spoken, you will hear the silence through, you will listen to the silence, in fact, through hearing the spoken word or reading the printed word. See, this is the kind of living transformation that takes place in the person. These are the, at least so it seems to me, these are the profundities of the religious life, the religious consciousness, and religious living. Now, I ask you, we started off with this business about the problem of living the religious life in the world of affairs, and we have our problems. Entering something like this mode of awareness, what happens to my problems? If I am aware of my situation in terms of the worldling's mode of awareness, everything is related to me. I want everything to aggrandize me or make it comfortable for me, make it safe, secure, and all the rest of it. But if I am aware of existence in this way, I see the fact as it is and no relationship to a separate me. This relationship to a separate me, which I set up through my ignorance, this is the real avidya, which I set up through my ignorance, is the thing that spoils my seeing the fact. Therefore, the entire situation from moment to moment, which to me is very pleasant thus and thus, and very disagreeable thus and thus, becomes totally devoid of the elements of pleasantness and disagreeableness. The situation remains the situation. Supposing my bank balance is very low, supposing some illness comes about, etc., etc., or what we call the pleasant things as well as the unpleasant things in life, you see? The situation will be that. But because in unself-consciousness I see the fact as the fact, my response to it will be in terms of immediate, spontaneous action which has no element of selfness in it at all. And therefore that will be pure action and right action. In that state, therefore, one does not seek to solve problems at all. There is no such thing as the solving of problems in terms which are determined by the separate me. No such thing. But there is the wonderful mystery of living life as the true human being, unself-consciously. So now, shall we just try and draw the threads together very swiftly? The living of the religious life brings about, that is to say, if one does live the religious life, brings about the transformation of the whole person. This transformation is essentially marked by the transformation of the mode of one's awareness of existence. The ordinary mode is one in which everything is related to self, self is something separate from the not-self, and the self tries to orient and order the whole of life in terms which are agreeable to the self. And here is the root of all our misery and trouble and all the rest of it. But when the attentiveness becomes so intense, so white hot, so perfect, that the self-conscious attentiveness becomes an unself-conscious attentiveness, there is no me present at all, no I present, there is only awareness present, then the whole situation is completely altered. The fact is seen, the truth is seen by your own mind and awareness being the fact which is seen. It has coalesced with it. It has become unlimited. And then your action is right and pure action. You are the pure human. And here is human fulfillment. You see, we are concerned not with the little things suitable for the children, the kindergarten. We are concerned with transcendence. Not in any egoistic way. I see Everest there, and therefore I must climb up to it. There is no I which climbs up Everest. There is no Everest where the truly religious life is concerned. And this mysterious purity and perfection, its extraordinary wonder and beauty, will fill your whole being all the time in the midst of any and every circumstance.